Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, your host, and it's great to have you with us wherever you are in the world. I hope you're keeping safe and well. We're in Series 6 now, and if you haven't caught our first episode featuring Richard Osman and Anthony Horowitz, then do go and seek it out, because it's well worth a listen. Well, we think so anyway. Before we get into this, our second episode of Series 6, if you're a new listener or you haven't yet followed us on social media, then we urge you to do so, because we love to hear from you and we love to say hello. And every week in this series, we are giving away one of the books that we feature on the podcast. So to be in with your chance of winning, follow us at Odo Book Off on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, wherever you are. Say hello and look out for how to win the book giveaway. Anyway, enough from me. Let's get on with the podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by two fabulous authors who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on in the Book Off. They are the author and academic Sarah Moss and the international best-selling author of the Charlie Parker novels, John Connolly. Hello to you both. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
And hello, John.
It's lovely to be here. Thanks, Joe.
So great to have you both here, and thank you for joining me. I did a recording of one of these podcasts recently where, of course, naturally, the first thing we discussed was the weather, because we were all in different parts of the world. Naturally, I'm also going to ask you. So, Sarah, where do we find you and what's the weather like?
I'm in Dunleary and in Ireland. It's been raining all morning and I kept thinking I was going to go for a run, because if I go for a run and get wet, I can then go swimming and it won't be awful. But I didn't.
And John, you're in Ireland as well, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not too far down the road from Sarah in Rathgar in the centre of Dublin. Yes, it's been pretty miserable here. So, you know, it's perfect. Perfect lockdown, it's perfectly quarantine weather, where you think, actually, I'm quite glad I don't have to go out, it's fine. Yeah, even the dog didn't want to go out yesterday. I kind of looked out the door and went, nope, now you off you go, but I'm not an idiot.
Because actually, we've had a bit of a, in England anyway, and in the UK, we've had a bit of a heat wave, and it's made the quarantine-y lockdown working from home thing almost unbearable. And, you know, when the rain came, certainly in London, where I am, a few days ago, it was a real alleluia moment for me. I was outside on the balcony, like Tim Robbins in The Shawshank Redemption, just sort of like hands in the air, looking up at the rain. And it was a moment.
I was very smug about the heat wave. I hate hot weather. So I was talking to friends in England who were suffering, and it was lovely and cool here.
Yeah, I'm like that. We're like myself and Jenny, like Jack Spratt and his wife, in that she's from South Africa. She just hates cold and damp. And I'm a winter creature. I'm bred for the northern climes. And our next door neighbors are exactly the opposite. So she really likes the cold and he doesn't. And he at one point suggested, well, maybe we should swap. And I thought, well, let's keep that for like the zero option. Okay. There must be a little way around it. You know, we can open the window. She could wear an extra layer, but you know, let's not get too desperate.
Yeah. I think that's one for much further down the line. Yeah,
That's where you're like 6 months into lockdown and thinking, okay, we need some kind of change of scenery here.
So we're going to talk about
both of your new novels, and also do our book off, as I mentioned later on, where each of you gets 3 minutes to pitch us a book that you absolutely love, that you think we should all read, that many listeners may not know about. First, though, if I could come to you, Sarah, to talk about Summer Water, which is your latest, published by Picador. It's just come out. It's a wonderful book. I absolutely devoured it, and it was in two sittings because it's quite a short book. I mean, is it a novella, would you say?
I'm never quite sure how you define those. It's longer than Ghost Wall and shorter than some of my others.
But it's a really sumptuous book, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the campsite in the book and the day that it is set across.
Well, in some ways, it's even sadder than a campsite. It's a holiday park.
That's right.
With identical log cabins, and it's on the shores of a loch, which I don't exactly name, but people who know Scotland will know pretty much where it is. And the book takes place over 24 hours of torrential rain. And it started fairly autobiographically. We were on holiday in a holiday park in a Scottish loch, and it rained the whole time. And at the time, I was working on a much heavier and more difficult novel. And I became fascinated by the lives of the other people on the holiday park. Nobody talked to anybody. It was bizarre. I mean, if there was ever a moment when the British were going to overcome their reserve and have a conversation, that would have been it. But we didn't. I think we were all watching each other. Certainly my household was watching all the others. And I thought it was so strange that we were all there, really quite similar as far as I could tell, and in the same place at the same time, and all shut in to some extent by the rain. I mean, we put our coats on, went out anyway, because I had that kind of upbringing, and so do my kids. But it wasn't particularly easy or fun, and we were all, I'm sure, looking forward to the end of the holiday. But nobody really shared any of that.
I got a sort of Rear Window vibe whilst reading it. You know, that, I mean, only it wasn't just one person sat in a wheelchair with binoculars. It was sort of everyone looking in on everyone else throughout the book.
Yes.
And the rain, what was interesting about the fact that it was, you know, meant to be the longest day of the year, and yet it was absolutely hammering it down with that Scottish rain, is that there was a real sense from, I got from most of the characters, that they wanted to be outside. But the juxtaposition was that they sort of, you know, the ones that did go out and the ones that stayed in. And there was a real sort of pull and push of who's going to brave the elements and who isn't.
Yes. I mean, I used to think this sometimes on holidays with small children, that the trick is to stay out until it would be better to be in, and then to stay in until it would be better to be out. And you keep doing that long enough and bedtime comes. and it was that. It's that kind of dynamic for the whole day, that sometimes being inside is just so awful that being out in the rain would be better, but then you get really cold and wet and it's so awful that being inside with your family would be better, and then it goes the other way. And everybody has a different level at which they have to get out. For the teenagers, of course, it's quite early. For older people, it can come a bit later.
Motherhood, and indeed fatherhood, is another theme in this book, which I'll come on to in a moment. John, if I could come to you to talk about The Dirty South, and this is your latest novel. It's your, am I right in thinking it's your 18th Charlie Parker book?
Well, yeah, 18th and a novella, so yeah.
18 and a half.
Yeah. Like I said, I still don't know what a novella is either, but yeah. It's only that they can't charge quite as much for as a novel, I think.
Yes, apparently not. No, yeah. But Charlie Parker, for those, many listening will know your character Charlie Parker, that have read some of your other books, and maybe some people listening have never picked up a John Connolly book before, but he is a younger Charlie Parker in this novel. It's 97, I believe, and it's sort of a prequel. So tell us a little bit more about this book and the sort of culmination of the events in it.
Well, yeah, it is set prior to the events of my first book. And one of the difficulties, I think, if you've been writing a series for a long time, is you build up a kind of weight of history. The character arrives a bit like Jacob Marley with all of these chains every time. And it's one of, it can be quite difficult for a new reader to get involved. It's a bit like arriving at a party where everybody's already been having a long conversation and you're trying to nudge your way in with your glass of wine, and you're trying to follow something that has obviously been progressing while and proceeding while you weren't there. But it's also quite liberating for a writer to shake off a lot of that history and go back and say, I can start afresh. I don't have to worry too much about what was said 15 books ago, because the Parker novels form a kind of sequence, and they do kind of build on each other in a way that mystery fiction hasn't tended to. particularly. It was always very distrustful of that kind of sequencing. And so it takes place in Arkansas in 1997, because it's a very interesting period of history. We sometimes think of the South as being transformed by civil rights, and of course it was to a degree. But one of the great transformational moments in the South comes with the invention of air conditioning, which we don't really think about, because up until that point, you couldn't really have high-tech industry in the South. In fact, you could have very little industry that operated indoors because, hey, it was just simply too hot to work for much of the year. But also you can't manufacture components for airplane engines or missiles or electronics in a humid environment. And so the invention of air conditioning in the kind of the 50s and into the 60s transforms the South. And suddenly you have an influx of what are largely high-tech companies, aeronautical companies and military industrial companies. And they like it down there because there are very few unions. There are very few environmental controls, and you get these extraordinary tax breaks because they're just looking to have money going in. So it's a situation that was ripe for corruption, not just ripe for corruption, but ripe for towns being willing to sell themselves to big companies. Because if you had the possibility of transforming the lives of all your citizens, and all you had to do was agree to have a huge big company come in, or in some cases, US Missile Command went into southern towns. So you effectively cede control of your town to a company or to the military. And in return, you're going to be given prosperity. Your schools will improve. You know, you'll have better stores. Your children will have a better hope for the future. And so there is this trade-off that goes on. And I think that accelerated when Clinton was in power, because Clinton, more than Jimmy Carter, was a real Southern politician, you know, and he knew that he had to look after people, and he had made promises, and those promises had to be fulfilled. And so that was an interesting period to come back to and explore, because it is ripe with so many conflicts. And underneath it all, you have what are essentially a black underclass who are not going to benefit in quite the same way. They will see some kind of trickle down, but they're not going to benefit in the same way. And so the negotiation for them is very much more complicated. And also, one of the difficulties when you say it, it's essentially becomes a historical novel. You know, I obviously grew up in Dublin. It's relatively easy for me to go to the US and research a contemporary novel. It's very, very difficult to research and write a novel that's set 23 years in the past, because essentially you turn into Donald Rumsfeld. You know, there are known unknowns, there are unknown unknowns, and you're just waiting to trip over things that are just that you simply don't know are there buried in the undergrowth. But there's also a difficulty in that this is a society, even now, but particularly then, that's essentially run by white males. You know, the civil rights movement hasn't made that much progress in many ways. So it would be unusual to have a police department with a woman in charge, for example. It probably wouldn't have happened at all. Even when I was looking up contemporary reports, even small-town police departments that employed women at all tended to get newspaper articles. It was like, look, a woman, you know, look, a Jewish fella, look, you know, a woman what can do math. All of these things become quite extraordinary. And you certainly wouldn't have black people in positions of power in those institutions. And so while you have to reflect the reality of that situation, you're also trying to comment upon it in some way, especially in light of, you know, events and certainly in the last year in the United States. It is a process of negotiation. It's quite a complex business, setting a novel in that region at that time.
Yes, and I imagine it at some points must have felt a bit weird having to have a male as the chief of police, etc., when you might actually have liked to have written a female. But
oh yeah, and you find yourself shoehorning to a degree people of color and women into positions of authority that they probably wouldn't have had, because in some ways the book would be unreadable to modern eyes. You know, it would be a very difficult read, yeah. And quite an alienating read. So to some degree you have to make certain concessions, I think, in order just and that allows you to bring some of those issues into focus, to be fair.
In your novel, John, it's a small town and people knowing each other's business, and there's, you know, two grotty motels and things. And Sarah, in Summer Water, obviously it's the holiday park is not a town, but there are residents, because obviously there are characters in the book who own their cabin and they've been coming for years and things. I think David and Mary are the retired couple in the book who are sort of mourning the loss of neighbours who've moved on, who've sold the cabin. You mentioned that it sort of stemmed from you being on a holiday. How did you decide the characters that were going to tell this story? What made you choose Justine and David and Mary, Alex and Claire, etc.?
It was very playful because this was really a distraction project from another book that never saw the light of day. It was just a bit of fun. So I didn't really think, okay, we'll need an old person and a young person, and we'll need some men and we'll need some women, and you know, I need to think very carefully about who's here. I just started it and saw what happened. And it's almost a relay race of a novel. Each character gets a couple of hours and then it switches to another character whom they encounter in some way. It's not always a conversation. Sometimes it's just somebody looking out of a window and seeing somebody pass. But at that point, it moves on to someone else. So it very much depended on who that character saw at that point. And then I just kind of swung on to the next one.
Oh, I love that description of a sort of relay of a novel. That's brilliant because it does. It's almost like each chapter is the baton has been passed to tell us about the next couple of hours in the day.
Yes. Yeah.
For reading both these, but I must apologise also, by the way, for the neighbour above who's sanding their floor or drilling their shells.
I thought I was here somewhere. I was looking to see if I'd left a phone on or something. No. I thought I was having a stroke, you know.
One thing about living in a flat in London is you get great internet, but you also get people drilling their floors and walls, and there's nothing you can do about the sound. So I'm just throwing that out there as an apology.
When I was listening to Sarah just there, I was thinking, Sarah, that sounds like a really crap holiday that you were on. I don't want to say, you know. Even within the kind of constraints that we're all living under, that sounds pretty terrible.
Oh, we made the best of it.
Is it a place? Because I wondered if it was based on a real place, which obviously you don't name. And as you said, people who know will probably know. But is it a place you had been to before that you sort of frequented, or was it a one-off?
It's, I mean, the holiday park was a one-off, never to be repeated. The place itself has been, it's interesting because I've moved around a lot. I was born in Scotland, grew up mostly in Manchester, went to university in Oxford, then lived in Canterbury, Reykjavik, Cornwall, the West Midlands, and now here in Ireland. So I've moved around a lot, and there haven't been many places in my life that I've gone back to. I don't really like going back. I find it very difficult. But there's this one place in Scotland, which is very near where I was born. And there are, well, my mother always claims I learned to walk on that beach, but it's a very stony beach. So it would be a surprising place to learn to walk. I certainly learned to swim in that water. And I've been back there all my life. And I have good friends in Glasgow. And when I go visit them, we go there. And I've taken my kids back. And it's one of very few points of return for me. So that's where the novel is set.
What's amazing about the book and it being so short is I got a real sense of the place, you know, not knowing where it's sort of set or anything about that landscape. I knew from your writing the sort of place it was. I got a real sense of the cabins, of the lock, of the weather. And similarly, John, with yours, you know, I felt like I was there, having never been to Arkansas, and certainly not into a small town like Carrigal or anything like that. I really felt like I was living in the town. Is it important that you have visited the places that you're writing about?
Yeah, I'm a hopeless novelist in that I tend to be very bad at making things up. So the more input I have from real life, the better for me. So yeah, it becomes, for me, it's always been similar to the process of researching a film in that I go to a place, I walk around, I have a camera. I mean, the good old days, I had a camera, now I always have my phone and a notebook. And then I try to spend a little bit of time in place, and I will talk to people. I find that people, and Sarah has found this, people are very helpful. People generally want you to get things right. And they have all of these experiences that they're very often willing to share. And so I end up with finding two people. I was staying in a place called Hot Springs when I went. And Hot Springs is a very odd place. It's full of bathhouses, these old bathhouses, because it was where people used to go to take the waters for a long time. And gangsters used to go there to spend their, because even gangsters need holidays, you know. And I was staying in this appalling hotel, which was like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. It was the most frightening hotel I'd ever stayed in. It was huge. It had weird things like abandoned barber's chairs in corridors and old speak-your-weight machines that didn't work anymore for no particular reason that I could see. And I love a couple, somebody got in touch with me and said, oh, I know exactly where you are, you know. And they were a couple called Webbs, and it turned out that they had grown up in Arkansas just the period of time in the novel. So they were very helpful. And then I found this wonderful man called J.R. Howard, and J.R. Howard had served in every branch of law enforcement in Arkansas during his career. And he was just this extraordinarily generous man with his time and with his knowledge. And so what you do is you build up this massive information, your own personal experience, what you've got from other people. And then it's taken me 20 years to learn this, to be honest. You then throw out 98% of it. You know, that's very difficult. You whittle it down to really just the essentials, because one of the difficulties with writing a historical novel, and I've read a couple of prequels recently where people have obviously gone back to rewrite, is they become over-concentrated on making sure that you know that they know about the period. So they're forever telling you what's on the radio, or you'll get one of those awful nods, you know, where somebody pulls out a big cell phone and they'll go, oh, cell phones, they'll never catch on, will they? And it's like getting a big nudge in the ribs from the writer going, you see what I did there? And I was very anxious not to do that. So in many ways, while I was trying to recreate a particular time, it almost feels timeless in a way. It doesn't really have any concern with the music that's on or very many new technological developments. And to some degree, that's a reflection of the place. When I was looking in the Washita, which is that area that the book is set, what struck me for the first time was they still have video libraries. Yeah. You know, when was the last time anybody here saw a video library? Well, they have video libraries for two very good reasons. One is that there isn't wide access to broadband internet. You know, they're up in the mountains, you know, so you don't have access to Netflix. You don't have access to these. A cable is quite expensive to get up there. And also people are quite poor. And actually, I have friends in Maine who are in the same position. They don't have internet at home because actually it's just that expense that's slightly too far that they don't particularly need, and they can piggyback on it at a Starbucks or if they're in work. And so, you know, and it was one of the reasons why I got very annoyed a few years back. There were a number of American writers in particular who had kind of sold themselves as shills to Amazon. You know, and we're not just prophesying the death of bookstores, but actually kind of preparing to dance on the graves of bookstores. And went, oh, we don't need bookstores. Everybody has access. You know, these tablets are really cheap. And suddenly you can have the whole world's library at your fingertips. And that's all very well and good if you have internet. If you don't have internet, that thing is no good to you. And there's a reason why. That's one of the reasons why libraries and bookstores become so important to us, you know. So I was quite glad when history proved those people to be entirely wrong, because it does seem to me that to some degree that at the very least, the ebook sales are plateaued and very possibly are going down. I can see it in my own figures that actually they're becoming less of a percentage of my overall sales than they once were. And I don't mind as long as people pay for books, but I am very glad to see that libraries and physical bookstores survived and are actually to some degree continuing to thrive, which is wonderful. So we got slightly off the topic there, but it is interesting to see that actually it felt to some degree the Washita felt like a place out of time.
And actually, yeah, we went off topic in a meander, but that a very good meander. And what I will say is I have never been able to do e-readers, and I am in a fortunate position to, you know, have the internet and probably be able to afford one if I wanted one. But for me, it's all about having the physical book in front of me and holding it and taking it around with me.
Yeah, and I also feel with your kids as well, your kids learn by what they see around them. I mean, me and my kids, because we lived in a house full of books, it seemed quite natural for them to have access to books, that books would be nearby. They were curious about what they were, what function they performed. And so we would read to them. But if you have a house that, you know, doesn't have any books and all it has is a screen, it's essentially a distraction device on which you can read a book, but you can also go on the internet, watch a film, play a game. All of those things are much more, to some degree, are much more immediately engaging than a book. A book requires some kind of investment of time and investment of patience. You have to learn the skill of reading to some degree. I always think, you know, what happened if that future had come to pass? You would have had houses essentially that didn't have books in them, apart from the kind of lunatic collectors like me who love being surrounded by books, even books that I might never read again. The fact that they had them on the shelf, I knew that they were there. So I always thought it was very important that we forget that children are so visual, that they look around and they see, what is this? What is this? What is the purpose of this? And what happens if you cut children off from that? If you put them in a world that essentially doesn't have books, what you have is simply, as we know, is children who then don't read.
Mm. Sarah, are you surrounded by physical books? Are you possibly not as mad a collector as John, but I imagine you have quite a habit too.
Thanks, Joe.
I've just moved internationally with It was more than 200 boxes altogether, and most of them were books. So yes, wow. I'm familiar with this problem. I've always been very resistant to ebooks and tablets. And then I went to Japan on my own for 3 weeks, in fact, to research a novel. And I realized at that point, when I was filling my suitcase with hardbacks, because I had all this lovely time alone coming up, that I was clearly never going to switch to ebooks. I mean, if you'll travel to Japan with a suitcase full of books, it's not going to happen.
No, but true.
I love you, Sarah. You're great.
And also, I love the packing process of them. Like, that is part of it for me, slotting them in around the clothes and making sure they're safe.
Choosing the books, choosing the right books.
Yes.
Yes, if anybody wants to come over and help me pack books when we buy a house soon, very welcome.
We're really busy. Thanks for the offer, but we're kind of busy that day.
John's only down the road. He can come.
I can't even say I'm going away somewhere. I can't wish I was there.
No excuse, have you now? And Sarah, just on that previous point, not to dwell on it, but obviously you wrote Summer Water based on a place you'd been, but it, for other books and for future writing, is it important that you know it and you, like John, you know, you're speaking to people to get a real sense of it?
I was thinking about that because I always say that my books nearly always start with a place, which is true. But I think Summer Water is the first time, certainly the first time for a while, that I've set a book in an actual place. Usually there's a place that's a beginning and then I make it up.
Yeah.
Which is partly because it's just more convenient. I mean, if you can move the rivers and the coasts and the cities around so that you can have people doing what you need them to do, that's a lot easier than being constrained by geographical reality. And I suppose also one has less responsibility to an invented world and less worry about upsetting people or getting things wrong. It feels safer in some ways.
Yeah, and you don't get the old messages coming through going, I think you'll find that you mentioned that that railway track was actually going to, you know, and you can sort of avoid all of that, can't you?
Well, you'll always get someone who says, actually, I've checked what the weather was like in July 1847, and I think you'll find. Yeah, okay.
John, I spoke to a mutual friend of ours, Mark Billingham, very recently, who has published a prequel to his character Thorn this year, and he was saying that, you know, he tries to write his books so that anyone can come to them at any time, but that actually, you know, for anyone who hadn't picked up one of his Thorn novels, the new one is a great place to start. Just thinking about The Dirty South and thinking of listeners who may not know of Charlie Parker yet as a character, would you say this is a good in for new readers?
Yeah, but it is. It's a book that allows people to start again in a way, and it's quite nice in a series to give people little plateaus or little points at which they can come into a series. But it also, I was very consciously trying to undo an error in the book. When I wrote my first novel, there is a confrontation between Parker ultimately and the man who may be responsible for what happened to his wife and child, and or who Parker knows is responsible. And he's trying to find out why this man might have done what he did. And the man gives him an answer in the book that I wrote back when I was in my 20s that I was never happy with. The reply that is, and it's a three-word reply, and I was never happy with it. It never encapsulated what I was trying to do. And so one of the reasons for writing the book was to allow that to be read in a different way. And so the book, The Dirty South, replicates that conversation to a degree, but reverses the roles. And suddenly that error that was committed in Every Dead Thing is no longer an error. The three words that are spoken actually assume a completely different meaning and have a completely different resonance because of it. So it was one of the things that interested me, not just to go back, but to go back and perhaps allow the books that follow to be read in a different way, and to give readers who are already familiar with them almost a new perspective on characters that were really familiar to them, perhaps over-familiar to them by the stage. And now you look at them and think, okay, actually, that's a very... I've never really thought of it in that sense. I've never really looked at them. It's that sense of new light through old windows, I suppose. I'm due to talk to Mark on Thursday, so I'm only about a third of the way through Cry Baby, but I'm enjoying it very much. I'm a big fan of Mark.
Yes, aren't we both? And I suppose knowing a character as you do, having written Charlie for so many years now, it makes it easier to be able to go and write something like a prequel because you sort of know what's ahead in his life.
Yeah, I suppose you do. But also, when I began writing those books, I was in my 20s, and Parker, when by the time Every Dead Thing was published, I was 30, and Parker in the books is about 32, and I'm 52 now. Mm. So suddenly, you know, how do you stay so youthful? Well, you know, there's a lot of goats and cockerels being sacrificed in the basement, and it really does seem to be working. But so my perspective on him is actually very different now. And it's funny, one of my, Claire, who looks after some internet stuff, we read it, and she said, you know, she'd forgotten how, in some ways, how difficult he is to like at that age, you know, or how troubled he is, and how hostile he is. And the character has mellowed so much that I almost had to go back and try and remember a time when he wasn't like that, you know, when he had so much rage and so much confusion. So it was it was interesting. It was nice to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. You know, which is a very good attitude, I think, to have to the past.
Very good, yeah. Sarah, I'd mentioned earlier about this sort of theme of motherhood, of parenthood in Summer Water. And it's something that just struck me, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. But, you know, from the very opening of the book, where Justine, one of your characters, is sort of up early and is going running and having a bit of time for herself before it's all about the kids, there are other little mentions of mother-children relationships and the way that husbands and fathers are sort of approaching it as well. And I know that, you know, this book sort of came out of writing another one and it's playful and everything, but did this sort of theme of parenthood just evolve as you were writing it, or was it something you sort of wanted to put into it?
It evolved, and I think partly it's inevitable writing about families on holiday, because that's almost the only dynamic that's going on there. But I people sometimes say you write a lot about parents and children, and I kind of think, what else is there for the novel to do? I mean, you know, there are some answers to that question, but it's the most basic shared experience. We don't all have children, but we certainly all have parents. And we all feel formed by our parents genetically, but also in narrative terms. And one of the legacies of Freud and psychoanalysis is that we think of parenting and family as storytelling. My father's story is this, and it creates my story in this way. I can explain how I feel now by looking back at the story of my mother. So there's a sense in which family life itself is woven out of storytelling, out of fiction.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'd like to turn to the book off now. And this is where each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book that you love, something we may know or may not, and you think that we should all read. Before I do that, I just want to ask you what you've been reading recently. With lockdown, I remember talking to some authors who said, oh, I just haven't been able to read. You know, the concentration levels were down. And then by about May, June, you know, people picking books back up again or writing again, getting creative. And I just wondered, John, what have you been reading lately?
I went to a trilogy of books that I had always meant to get around to, which was Edna O'Brien's Country Girls trilogy, which I'd always been put off by because I thought it would be Irish miserabilism, I suppose, and having grown up in Ireland during enough Irish miserabilism, I didn't think I needed to read books about it. But I was really surprised, certainly by the first two, about how just how funny they are and how clever and how touching, as well as being certainly for the I can see for the time why they would have been so controversial in such an insular society in every sense of the world. The final novel I could have done without in the trilogy, to be perfectly honest. I don't think it matches up to the others. But the first two were quite wonderful.
It's like and The Godfather in that respect, is it?
Yeah, it is. You kind of think you could have left it alone. You know, surely you were just doing that for the money by the end. So I really like that. I'm going to fess up a little bit here. I've become very conscious, I think, as a male reader, of just how often I tend to default to male writers. I became conscious of it about the last couple of years. It's just something that, you know, I should have realized a long time ago, but I didn't. And so I'm to say that I'm consciously trying to expand my reading, it probably makes me sound sadder than I really am, but I admit to being a little bit sad. But I think it is something, it's a weakness in male readers, I think, that we tend to turn more frequently towards male readers than not. And I can hold my hand up and say I could justify it in part because I'm such a nerd that so much of what I read tends to be music and film writing. And men in particular tend to immerse themselves in the minutiae of music in a way that women don't often do, because women tend to have much better things to be writing about. But in terms of fiction, to some degree, reading Edna O'Brien was a slap on the wrist for me because it reminded me of how dumb I'd been for so very long. At least even now, later in life, I'm trying to improve as a person. I keep telling that to my children and my other half, and they look at me skeptically as I brandish a book list and go, look, I'm a better person.
Tick. What about you, Sarah? Have you been able to read? Have you been reading lots?
Yes, I always read. And I was slightly surprised by people who couldn't read in lockdown because I read through everything, so it didn't seem any different, really. I've been reading Mark O'Connell's Notes from an Apocalypse, which I liked very much. I read it quite early in lockdown at a point where it seemed ridiculous to be reading anything apocalyptic because there the apocalypse was happening. But I really liked it because it's kind and clever. It's a book about people who, it's nonfiction. It's about people who are preparing for the apocalypse. So Americans in bunkers and the super rich buying up bits of New Zealand in the hopes that they alone will survive with the cockroaches. But it's very kind and very clever. It's thoughtful, and he's not making fun of people. It would be very easy to make fun of. And he's acutely aware of, but not self-lacerating about his own point of view. So yeah, I like that, even though it was a slightly strange time to be reading it. And a novel by Kauai Strong Washburn called Sharks in the Time of Saviors, which is set in Hawaii. And it was the first novel I'd read set in Hawaii. I don't think I'd thought about Hawaii much at all before. And beautifully written, overcame my usual fixed objection to anything involving any kind of fantasy or alternative reality. And there's not very much of it, but it's a strand. And I really enjoyed that.
Fantastic. It's time for the book off. And before we find out who goes first, who goes second, let's find out the books that are going head to head. John, what are you putting forward in the book off?
I'm putting forward a book called Child of All Nations by a German writer named Irmgard Kuhn.
Fantastic. I don't know it, actually, so I look forward to hearing more. And Sarah, what is your choice?
Dorothy Wordsworth's Grasmere Journals.
Grasmere Journals, yes, which will they will have been written late 18th century?
That's right, yes, 1790s, early 1800s.
Yeah, right, fantastic. Okay, well, Sarah, you get to decide whether you'd like to go first or second. What would you prefer?
I'll go first.
You go first and get it over with.
Yeah.
which means, John, you get to decide how you are ceremoniously cut down in your prime when the 3-minute mark hits. So you can either be rung out by the school bell or honked out by the bicycle horn. Which
they're
would
both,
you prefer?
They're both equally horrible, but yeah, they're awful. For the sake of everybody, I think the bicycle horn is slightly less awful.
Okay.
Let's just stop before 3 minutes. So
you don't worry. I'll keep an eye on my watch. 2:59.
Yeah, if you can bring it in just before, then I'll be very impressed. You don't have to use your whole 3 minutes. That's not part of it. But when the clock hits three, I will be honking you out, John, and ringing you out, Sarah. So I've put 3 minutes on the clock. It's over to you, Sarah, to start and tell us about The Grasmere Journals by Dorothy Wordsworth.
Thank you. I've chosen The Grasmere Journals because it was one of the books that helped me to understand the relationship between domesticity and writing and think in much less binary terms about how a person might combine living with other people, doing housework, being responsible for cooking with an intellectual life. And I'm going to read a very short paragraph which will still fit within my 3 minutes. Sunday, the 7th of February, 1802. A fine, clear, frosty morning. The eaves drop with the heat of the sun all day long. The ground thinly covered with snow, the road black, rocks black. Before night, the island was quite green. The sun had melted all the snow upon it. Mr. Simpson called before William had done shaving. William had had a bad night and was working at his poem. We sat by the fire and did not walk, but read The Peddler, thinking it was done. But lo, though William could find fault with it, with no one part of it, it was uninteresting and must be altered, poor William. The William there, of course, is William Wordsworth, who is much more famous than his sister Dorothy. But throughout this journal, you see how the work of writing is understood collaboratively. Dorothy does most of the housework and cooking, but there's a lovely bit where she pulls Wordsworth away from writing a lyric poem to go dig a path through the snow to the necessary being the outside toilet. And it's really about the integration of literary production with domestic work, with physical exercise, with just the basic responsibilities of being alive, the need to wash yourself and your clothes and make sure that there's food and take the rubbish out. And having had a very traditional education, I'd always thought of those things as being in tension with each other, that the washing up would stop you writing or doing the laundry would mean you couldn't read. And this book for me modelled a very beautiful way of holding all of those things together in a relaxed and creative way. And thinking about authorship, not just as the work of the genius on the mountainside, which Wordsworth is often imagined to be, but as something that's produced in a household alongside other kinds of making. And it's also very beautifully written and set in the Lake District.
Wow. Oh, look at that. You've got about 35 seconds to go there. Did you do that on purpose so that you spared getting that, Sarah?
Yeah.
That's a lovely pitch, and we'll talk more about that book in a mo, but you can have a little breather now, Sarah. You can have a rest because it's over to John. I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you, and it's over to you, John, to tell us about Child of All Nations.
Well, Child of All Nations is a book that was published in 1938 by Irmgard Kuhn. And Kuhn had been, the Nazis had declared her an immoral and un-German writer. And so she had to write and publish under pseudonyms before eventually she fled Germany. And the book is told from the perspective of a child called Cully. And Cully is 9 years old. And her parents have been declared non-citizens by the Nazis. So they have no passports. And they are refugees trying to get out of Europe. And her father is a writer. He's relying on advances. He hustles. He's forever taking advances from one publisher for a book that he might eventually write. And advances from another publisher for the same book. And hoping that he won't get caught. And the mother is trying to her best to hold the household together. But Kuhn's, what she does brilliantly, the great creative decision in the book is that, in fact, Kuhn at the time would have been closer to the age of the mother than the child. But she gives Cully the awareness of an adult. So Cully is very funny. She's very clever. She sees through people. She has a knowledge that a nine-year-old girl shouldn't really have. There's a wonderful line where she wonders why people complain about giving, that they won't give the money, because she says, money isn't something that becomes unhappy or starts crying if you leave it. You know, it annoys me when people don't hand over their money when we need it. And it could be a really depressing book. But it isn't, because Cully is so funny and the book is suffused with hope. And I find Kuhn a very interesting figure because she managed to sneak back into Germany via the Netherlands, apparently because the Daily Telegraph announced her suicide. And so the Germans thought she was dead and she managed to slip back into the country. Although her biographer wasn't entirely sure. He wasn't entirely sure this was true. And he had a lovely description for the fact that she liked mythologizing her life. And he said at one point that Irmgard Kuhn had a very special relationship with the facts of her life, which is something that I've now adopted for my own. If people tell me that, you know, you're lying, I go, well, actually, I have a very special relationship with the facts of my life. And so she ended up in poverty. She suffered a lot from alcoholism and mental illness and was rediscovered towards the end of her life. And actually, for the last 4 or 5 years of her life, she was an acclaimed book. But in this time of refugees from war and conflict, where we see them every day on the news, it's an extraordinarily relevant book. And it's a beautiful, hopeful, funny book. And I just wholeheartedly love it and wholeheartedly recommend it.
Oh, fantastic. Another one at 225 there, John. So you had Seconds to Spare as well. Oh, you've both done it on purpose. I'm still going to give you the horn, though.
Oh, God.
As it were.
what a rotten human being you are. Completely.
No.
You know, even before lockdown, people didn't want to be in a room with you.
Do you know what? Some people tune into this podcast just to hear those two sound effects. So, you know, fabulous. Thanks, John. Have a breather. Sarah, I loved this idea, which is obviously the reason you picked it, of this domesticity and the sort of life of, you know, academic and literature's sort of combining, something which I suppose hadn't really thought about. And you don't think of Wordsworth as like having to dig the trench, really, do you?
No. But they were very poor at this point. It was years before he became famous. Mm. And he's digging the path to the loo and he's picking apples and he's chatting to people who come by and walking miles to post things and helping Dorothy wash her hair and hanging up the laundry.
And is it a sort of a nature writing as well? Is it a sort of love letter to where they were at the time?
I think it's more practical than a love letter. She's very, very attuned to shifts in light and weather and the changing of the seasons and the passage of beggars and farmers and people working the land. But she is, as Wordsworth actually also was in a lot of his poetry, rigorously practical about it. There's no attempt to brush poverty and suffering under the carpet. They go to the funerals of village children who die. They console the mothers. They have to decide how much of their own pretty limited resources they're going to share with passing beggars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yes, there's nature writing in that there's a lot of appreciation of the natural world, but it's not romantic in that sense.
Right. And I love the thing you said in the pitch. You said the basic responsibilities of being alive, which I just thought is a lovely sort of turn of phrase, really.
It's why I write so much about daily life in my fiction, because that is actually how most of us meet life most of the time. The things that we spend a lot of time doing are the washing up, the laundry, finding the kids' shoes, remembering to go to the bank, picking up some apples on the way home. And that's, I was thinking about it recently, we think in eras, but we don't live in eras, we live in moments. And so I'm interested in writing those moments. And that's partly a political decision, that if we decide that what most people, and particularly most women, actually spend most of their time doing is not worthy of literature, that's not a literary thought, that's a political thought.
Well, I thought it was a great pitch, and it's definitely a book that I'll want to seek out. And John, again, I hadn't heard of Child of All Nations at all, but you've sold it to me there, especially when you first started talking about it and, you know, you even mentioned this in your pitch, I thought, gosh, that could be a bit heavy. But actually, like you say, because of Cully and because she's funny and she's got this sort of adult awareness, actually it's a book, a hopeful book, and it sounds a bit like it's even, you know, in sort of humorous and light in places.
It is. It's surprisingly so. It reads like sophisticated 1930s comedy, thanks to that voice. And it's actually really short. It was reissued a few years ago as a Penguin Classic, and it's only about 120 or 130
Ooh,
pages
perfect.
Long. It's a lovely short read. It doesn't overstay its welcome. A bit like, you know, I presume the people that they were staying with in the book kind of went, geez, I hope you're not going to stay longer than a week, you know, much as I love you and sympathetic though I am to your plight. But no, it's a really wonderful book. And it was one of those, again, I don't want to harp on about bookstores. It was one of those serendipitous things. One of the things I love about bookstores is when staff members do a handwritten note about a book and stick it on the shelf. And they're clearly the ones who've gone to the manager and say, I can sell 20 copies of this book because I love it. And I very rarely pass one of those by without reading it. And more often than not, I'll take a chance on the book. And that was one of those fortuitous discoveries.
Yeah. Well, John, you can harp on about bookshops all you like on this podcast because we do. We celebrate the joy of them and how much we love them. So always welcome. I also loved the character of the dad mentioned there, this sort of hustling writer who gets advances but never actually delivers.
Yeah, we don't know anybody like that. Thank you. That's complete fiction, you know. We're all trustworthy individuals, you know. As my publisher taps the watch for the book that's due to be delivered on Thursday, going, it is coming, isn't it?
What's he swanning off recording a podcast with Joe for?
What are you talking to that Haddo Joker for, you know?
I loved hearing both of those. So thank you for bringing the books to our attention. I've got to pick one to take home and, as it were, because, you know, we're not in the same room, so I can't nick it off you. I'm going to choose The Child of All Nations, I think, this time, because it sounds like it's, as you said, John, very relevant for now.
I'm shocked, but I'd like to thank everybody who made this possible. My mum, my dad.
Having said that, the Grasmere journals sound brilliant as well. And Sarah, I'll be sure to check those out. I do find now, I don't know if this is just something I've discovered or it's because I've got a bit older or I'm reading more, whatever it is, but I actually quite like to read fiction and then read non-fiction, sort of, you know, one and the other and flip-flop between both. It's almost like I get a break from fiction by going into a non-fiction world and then I come back and, you know, it's a balancing act now, but maybe this could be one of my non-fictions that falls in between some of the novels I've got coming up. It's been a pleasure having you both here. Thank you so much for your time, for your recommendations. Summer Water by Sarah Moss is out now. It's published by Picador. And The Dirty South by John Connolly is also out now. It's published by Hodder and Stoughton, and they are both absolutely fabulous. I can't recommend them highly enough. And if you haven't read a Charlie Parker novel before, then this is a very good place to start. And if you haven't read a Sarah Moss novel before, this is equally a really great place to start. Sarah, John, it's been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully next time we'll be in the same room, and after speaking, recording, or whatever it is we're doing, we'll head over and enjoy a nice pint together.
It would be lovely, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.